Good evening. My name is Bridget Flanagan, and I'm a member of the Bay Gourmet Forum of the Commonwealth Club of California. Welcome to our program tonight, Out Back to Out West, enjoying the wine, food, and beers of South Australia. We also welcome our radio listeners and invite our audience to visit us online at www.commonwealthclub.org. This evening, our moderator is Evan Kleinman. She is the owner and executive chef of Angeli Restaurant in Los Angeles. I hope I pronounced that correctly. She's also a best-selling author of a multitude of cookbooks, including Angeli's Pizza, Pasta, and Panini. She's on the board of directors of the Hollywood Farmers Market, and she's the past director of the Convivium for Slow Food in Los Angeles. She also leads travel programs in France and Italy, and she is also the host of Good Food, a radio program on KCRW. It's a weekly program, and she's done this program for 12 years. During that time, she's had an opportunity to talk to many experts on food and wine and many experts on Australia cuisine and wines about their food and their traditions. So I'd like to welcome Evan to the program, have all of you welcome her, and she's going to have an opportunity to introduce the other members of the panel.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Bridget. Hi. I would like to thank, first of all, the Commonwealth Club for asking me to come tonight and participate in this panel, because after 12 years of interviewing people, I find that asking questions is the way one elicits the most answers. And I get to learn a lot about a lot of different subjects. And there's a lot to learn here tonight, and I think we have the perfect group to teach us. So I will start here with Victoria Blumenstein. Victoria is a chef and caterer of Blumenstein's Catering up in Healdsburg, and she likes to play a lot with Australian products and wines, and she's very, very interested in issues of regionality and slow food. Then we have Adrian Hoffman. Adrian is the vice president and culinary director of the Lark Creek Restaurant Group. Adrian kind of fascinates me because he's an award-winning chef who's made the leap to be part of a larger restaurant group and gets to spend his time immersed in culinary minutiae, sourcing some of the best foods and wines to share with consumers through the restaurants. He also has a voracious fascination for regionality. Then we have Matt Lane, who works for Foster's, but not the Foster's you might think of initially, but rather he's director of wine education at Foster's Wine Estates, which has holdings all over the world. You may not know that. And then we have Thalassa Skinner. Thalassa, she lives now in Napa, and she runs the Oxbow Cheese Merchant, which resides within a wine shop. She has spent a lot of her time on farms and does a lot of community work. For years, she ran the farmers market in Barossa, which must have been just an amazing experience. She still has her hand in South Australia because her husband, ladies, she may have figured out the ultimate source of success in the world, but her husband lives and works in South Australia, and he is very involved in the wine business there. He works for Yolumba, which is a really interesting winery, the oldest family-run winery in Australia. And then we have Sally James. Sally is really an amazing ambassador for Australian wine and food. She spends her life trying to introduce consumers all over the world to Australian wine and food products. She's a chef, the author of many, many books on both food and on wine and on pairing both together, which is a subject that more and more people are very interested in. She's co-host of an upcoming PBS show that we're not sure when it's going to start airing, but it will air soon, Wine Roads, Tales of Adventure in Wine, Food, and Travel. Okay, so let's talk about South Australia. And I thought maybe Matt could start, because I think when you say the words wine and Australia, perhaps 20 years ago, people would have gone, what? And now the image they have in their head perhaps is a lot of critter wines, people call them, very inexpensive, large volume wine. And I would love for you to share the age of the Australian wine industry, if you could go back to the beginning and talk a little bit about how long people have been making wine in Australia.
Yeah, Evan, look, it's fantastic to be here. Firstly, just to correct you, all of those critter wines come out of New South Wales, which is...
I'm so happy to hear that.
Yeah, look, it has no correlation to the brilliance of South Australia. So,
perfect.
But look, you know, in essence, the Australian wine industry has been around since sort of around the 1820s, where a gentleman called James Busby, who was a Scottish botanist, came to Sydney. And basically with him, he brought about 600 clippings or cuttings via France, Rio de Janeiro and South Africa, and basically planted them in New South Wales or in downtown Sydney as we know it today. So the Australian wine industry basically is roughly about 160, 170 years of age. That said, and the more important factor of this evening, the South Australian wine industry, and interestingly enough, South Australia produces about 55% of Australia's premium wine. The South Australian wine industry basically began around 1840, and as we all know on the panel, South Australia was discovered or colonised in 1836. So the first literal wine company that came to South Australia was the Penfold Winery in 1844. So in essence, the South Australian wine industry has been around for about 166 years, and there are many great names to the Australian wine industry that have come out of South Australia. So when you look at the Australian wine industry in closing in a synopsis, sure, there's many wines in different tiers and there's wines to suit every taste, but from South Australia, you're really talking about the premium upper echelon wines. If not one of the greatest wines in the world comes from South Australia, and that's the Penfold Grange, arguably one of the greatest.
And either Matt or Sally, what are some of the varietals that we'd be speaking about when we're talking of this region?
Well, to, you know, take first stab, I think first and foremost, Australians pretty well lay their hat that they've discovered Shiraz. Despite the fact that it did come from France, we believe we own that variety. And at the end of the day, rightly so. It's been planted in Australia for that period of time, well over 150 years. So if you're looking at South Australia at whole, and I'll certainly throw to my two colleagues to the left who are both from the Barossa and South Australia, you'd be looking at Shiraz, followed by Chardonnay, and then obviously in the great area of the Coonawarra, you'd be looking at Cabernet Sauvignon, but Shiraz would definitely be the king.
I'd like to add South Australian Riesling to that, because even though it mightn't be really big here yet, it certainly is big with Australians, and particularly big with me, because it's so different to the classic Rieslings that many people are away from here, and it's really starting to make a mark here in this country, and you know, I couldn't begin to name the different companies that produce it, but South Australian Riesling is really, you know, worth looking out for. And we've got some awesome bubbly from there too.
How is it different? Describe the flavour profile of the Riesling.
You're probably better at doing the language.
Well, I think at the end of the day, when you look at Riesling across the globe, most people, and sadly in this country, are quite stereotypical to the word Riesling. They basically think it's sweet. Australian Riesling, in particular South Australian Riesling, is bone dry, and I mean bone dry. And you sort of serve it one step off sorbet in terms of its temperature. Its acid is relatively nervous and slightly bone-chilling in a way. It has just that dry vivacity to it. It's unique. It's one of the most unique varieties in Australia. I totally concur with Sally. I'd have to say it's South Australia's best-kept secret in terms of a white wine varietal, definitely Riesling. There's a Riesling for tasting this evening next door, and it is one of the best drinks I think you'll ever have.
Now, has it been grown for a very long time, or is it fairly new?
No, Riesling's been grown in Australia for, as far as I can document, and as far as our historic records will take us, about 70 to 80 years. In South Australia, a lot of the South Australian wine companies have been making Riesling for about 50 years, but we keep it inshore. We keep it in our home state because we love it so much. But Sally's right, slowly creeping offshore, and eventually the word will get out that South Australian Riesling is one of the great best-kept secrets of our great state.
Lassa, would you like to add anything about varietals in particular?
Well, I would agree that Riesling to me is one of my favorites, and I'd say in the Barossa, the Eden Valley Rieslings, you just can't beat them. And I actually had a wine epiphany on a Riesling, which was about 5 years ago, but it was a Riesling made in 1982,
And I had no idea that you could keep any white wine that long. I mean, I suppose you can, but it's not really how we drink them. But this, the winemaker actually brought it out for me, and it was like drinking nectar, and that's all I could think of when I had it. And the way it goes with food, it, you know, it's just a marriage made in heaven. But I also say there are quite a few blends that are made, and I know in the Barossa that's a fairly large thing, blending wines. So, and the other thing I always love, and I know I've brought it back to Napa and had winemakers poo-poo it, is sparkling Shiraz. And I love it. And it's just, we love it. Mm. I mean, we love it. We bring it out at Christmas. It's so festive. It's beautiful. Mm. You know,
why do people poo-poo it?
Like, well,
they used,
I think
to
we have in
Lambrusco?
Our minds still cold duck here. You know, the
that's so bad.
Red
in the
bubbles
day.
Is not something very pleasing. But really, it's beautiful stuff.
And it's the best breakfast drink you'll ever have.
Especially if you have a hangover.
Spoken by a man who
and I have
longer.
To say something, because no one's mentioning Barossa Simeon. And I'm sorry, it is probably one of the varietals that you don't see much here at all. And in terms of a food wine, yeah. It's an adult.
Yeah.
It's a chewy wine. And Barossa does Chardonnay, and sometimes it does it very well, but it always does Sémillon very well. And there's very few places in the world where you see it grown. And it's a very wonderful food wine. Mm. It has great mouthfeel, a bit of oily, and it can be crisp and acidic and ages well, just like a Chardonnay. So, yeah.
Yeah, no, kudos to Peter Lehman and Robert O'Callaghan at Rockford's and Grant Burge, three famous names in the Barossa Valley who pioneered that variety, particularly Peter Lehman. He's been pioneering that for about 30 years and certainly a forefront leader in Sémillon, considering that Australia's so-called best Sémillon comes from New South Wales and that of the Hunter Valley. But we think we've got a pretty good version in the Barossa Valley too.
Well, the word food has been mentioned a couple of times, and you can't talk about wine without talking about food, because one doesn't consume it in isolation. So let's talk a little
Some
bit
do.
About...
Sorry, it's true.
It is true. When I think about Australia, when I started to hear about Australia coming to the front of the conversation about food, was in the 80s, in the early 80s, which was right about the time I was opening my restaurant and sort of California was starting to wake up from various types of slumber regarding food. Let's talk a little bit about the food scene in Australia, how what it has become is so different from what it once was. Victoria, maybe?
Let's see. I moved there in 1987, and when I first arrived in Adelaide, the very first stirrings of our training programs, our what's called TAFE, which is our culinary four-year program, was beginning to take off, and we had some serious teachers, and there was finally a structure being put in place for how people used to do the whole apprenticeship thing in a restaurant. And for the very first time, our top chefs were coming into a school based in Adelaide and teaching at Regency and really starting to stir the pot of culinary. And you had some very, I mean, I think of people like Chong Liu and Serge Dansereau and people like that who really at that time had proven themselves on the world stage in terms of restaurants and then were coming back into South Australia and really beginning to inspire people. And then we also had a movement about that time which was probably a precursor to the English gastropub, which was our pubs really were. There was some big money going into them. The Coopers family especially were getting involved in some pretty big pubs. And you were seeing some pretty exciting food on a very accessible level. And that was, to me, the big beginning for South Australia especially. And that has spread. And then, like California, I think that about maybe the early 90s, slow food came on the horizon. There was an awareness of slow food. And there was a real desire to promote the region and for people to look around their own region and open their eyes and go, I don't have to buy, you know, meat from New South Wales. There's producers right here in my own backyard. And so you really saw the beginning of a food movement within not just South Australia, but certainly South Australia probably, I think, led the way. I think we had much more of an agricultural base to come from, and we had the movers and the shakers in the food industry like Maggie Beer, like Chong, like Serge, who really wanted to put South Australia on the map, and we're doing so.
I could have sworn Serge was a Sydney cider, but anyway.
He is now. He was there.
Speaking from a different perspective, I actually wasn't raised in South Australia, and I've moved all around Tasmania, New South Wales, Canberra, sort of you name it. Canberra actually is the capital of Australia, for those who don't know it. But aside from that, we're here for South Australia. But just to, I went through culinary school in the mid-70s, and the evolution that you mentioned, Evan, is just absolutely astounding. It's almost like how technology's gone in the last 20 years in the world. When I was going through college, pretty well for our lunches, we had a meat pie. And our treats were fish and chips, and it was so Anglo-Saxon, it was ridiculous. I mean, Chinese was sweet and sour pork. Our pizzas still had pineapple and ham on them. And I remember after that, I started doing profiles on chefs, and we started then getting a drizzle of chefs from around the world. You know, I remember one Amanda Percioco, I can't say his name properly, but Buonarroccordo in an Italian restaurant, and he lamented how a lady, he sent out his pasta and she wanted, or pizza, and she wanted pineapple on it. But at the same time, he was wondering how he can get the seafood purveyors to come to his door. And, you know, gradually you saw this kind of thing happening. But I saw two transitions. I saw one definite one where suddenly we're embracing everything around the world, and all the up-and-coming chefs, all their rules were taken away, and you saw every cuisine happening on every plate, because we've got a huge Asian influence. Yeah. We had a huge Mediterranean influence from the Greeks and Italians, and you know, Dutch, particularly Lebanese. In South Australia, yeah. Lebanese, Germans. Moroccan, all around, and then Pacific influence as well. And chefs got extremely excited by this and started mixing everything together. And Australia, for a while, they represented confusion. And then it evolved beyond that, where our chefs got itchy feet. And we're a very nomadic race. We like travelling around the world. And we would go and be trained by the best and then come back. And it's just remarkable seeing how different Australian cuisine is now to back in the 70s and even early 80s, where we really, you can get the best of any country's food around the world somewhere in Australia. You can get the best Korean, Malaysian, Vietnamese, and by the way, the best coffee anywhere. Yeah. We really do coffee excellently, and it's. I'm so proud now to be able to showcase not only the greatest restaurants, but our artisan producers, our cheese producers, have travelled to the world, learned from the mistakes of the old-time producers, and we're coming out with olive oils and all kinds of things that are just stunning.
I mean, it's one of the things that fascinates me the most about Australia, because I just feel like sort of the birth of this pot of diversity, speaking culinary-wise, is so similar to what we've experienced here in mm-hmm. California. Mm-hmm. And I want to ask you, maybe Vicky, because I know you, Victoria, because I know you wanted to talk about it, but also Adrian, what comes first in the wine and food sort of gestalt, the food or the wine? What drives what flavors? Now in South Australia, people are able to consume all of these different flavors, many of them quite forward, quite aggressive, spicy, a lot of spice. Do winemakers respond to that, or do the wine-growing regions themselves create a certain kind of synergy with the cuisine that's offered in them? Thalassa, too, might want to speak to this. Anybody start the conversation?
I guess I would say that I think it's a really interesting... I mean, I've spent... Of the 24 years I've lived in Australia, most of them have been in South Australia. So those are the wines that I certainly... My very first red wine was a Rockford Basket Press. Yay. So I got to start at the top. And I think that you would have to say that the Barossa Shiraz and the style Barossa Shiraz, the German heritage there with the smoked meats and the you know, the slightly salty foods, certainly lended itself to a big, bold Shiraz. I wasn't around in the beginning, so I'm not really sure, but I think, you know, certainly, like even with the Semillons, that slightly oily texture, that slightly, you know, fuller body certainly marries well with the food. There's never a problem. The high alcohol wines that have come in recent times, I don't find that to be food-driven. I think that's consumer-driven. I don't think that has anything to do with the regional food that we've got going. That's my own personal opinion. And I find that, as of somebody who is trying to pair food and wine, much harder to deal with as a chef. So,
Adrian?
I think I'm not such a... We were all introduced as experts on Australian food and wine, and out of everybody here, I've spent by far the least amount of time in Australia, and I don't consider myself an expert. What I will say is we spent about 9 days there from Lark Creek in the spring, and we were led around and saw the very best of what South Australia had to offer. So it's interesting because when I came, I didn't know what Australian food was, and all I had in my mind were all the things you heard about in the late 80s that Sally was referring to before, that, you know, a Pacific Rim fusion, kind of a melding of many cultures in one space, sometimes not so successfully. And what was very interesting is that when we got there, and every meal we had, I was trying to think about, you know, we're doing this promotion, how am I going to best represent what's going on in South Australia? What I saw was virtually the same thing that's going on in California, which is, you know, local, sustainable, the very best ingredients you can get your hand on. And we were sampled such wonderful cheeses and produce and meats that are all, that's what they have there, and that's what they use and cook with. It was really interesting because it's virtually the same thinking that we use in California, creating the best from what we have locally, and people that have studied with great cheesemakers in France and all this. We had such wonderful cheeses and beautiful wines. It was great.
Before I get to Lhasa, Matt, talk to me a little bit about now this idea of high alcohol wines, because in California we're dealing with this too. So the idea that it's consumer driven, the high alcohol wines, but for people who really love to pair wine with food, it can be sort of really tough. And do you think that that's going to change anytime soon?
Yeah, look, it's a great question. I think before I answer that, I just want to back up Sally's statements about chefs going offshore. There's the antithesis to that. Some of the greatest chefs in the world have come to Australia and are setting up restaurants. You know, a good friend of mine, Gordon Ramsay, is now setting up 3-4 restaurants in Australia. You've had everyone from Guy Savoy, Jean Robuchon. You've had some of the greatest chefs, or Jean Robuchon, the chef of the century, have come. Paul Bocuse, they've all come to Australia. So that's a big kudos to Australian cuisine. And then you've got the offshore exports like Neil Perry and Tetsuya Okada and so forth. But look, to your point, it's definitely a trend. I certainly agree with Vicky. I'm not a fan of high levels of ethanol in a wine. At the end of the day, it will decrease. A lot of the wine companies, in particular us, are working to decrease that. And look, at the end of the day, it's such an old comment but so true. You make a wine in a vineyard, you don't make it in a winery. So if you can control that within the vineyard, you'll control those problems of alcohol and ethanol within the winemaking process. So look, it is a fad. It's consumer-driven. That said, certainly not going to point anyone out. But the media, the wine media, in essence, have certainly fueled that excitement, and that's where you get.
You can point somebody out if you.
Oh want. No! I don't want to go through that retaliation stage. That I do that enough after hours. But look, I think that said, there's a reason why, you know, there was a coined phrase a few years ago: "You need a knife and fork to drink this," for Barossa Valley Shiraz. But look, I think in closing, a lot of the vintners now understand the importance of a balanced wine, and a balanced wine is not a wine with high levels of ethanol, period.
Thalassa, your history sort of fascinates me, because as the manager of a farmer's market in an area so highly thought of like Barossa, you're sort of on the ground where consumers and producers come together and sort of have a party.
Mm-hmm.
It's true.
It is
true. Exactly what it was.
It is true.
Every Saturday, big party.
A big party. And there's a lot of sharing and a lot of opinions, and a lot of minds get opened at farmers markets. Could you speak a little bit to sort of the regionality of food and the fact, regionality versus terroir a little bit in the Australian industry? Because the Australian wine industry is so interesting in that it was able to conceive itself without a lot of rules of appellation that sort of hold back old world wines, people might say.
Mm-hmm. Well, to preface it all, I actually managed the St. Helena Farmers Market before I moved over to the Barossa. And so I had a pretty strong understanding of how farmers markets, at least in California, which are really well developed and have a very strong set of rules, regulations that are in place to protect farmers and consumers. So I went, when I moved over to the Barossa, I was actually, it just happened to be dumb luck, really, that it was just coming to Australia, the whole concept of a farmers market. So for me, I was part of starting it up as well and setting up the rules, at least for the Barossa. Quite a fascinating experience in general. And the market now is, how old is it now?
It's going to be six this in October.
Six in October, right.
Well, I'm just going to put a shout out to Los Angeles. We just celebrated our 30th anniversary of the first market.
and St. Helena, I believe, is 26.
Yeah.
So, I mean,
it's pretty wonderful.
Yeah. But again, very new concept. And I think that's a very important point in the whole thing. I mean, there's a couple of issues to bring up. Regionality. The Barossa, for those who haven't been there or don't know, is very is German. Lutheran background, Silesian actually, and very, very strongly so. The cured meats, I mean, Victoria isn't just a chef. She can actually take apart an entire animal and use every single piece of that beast. I mean, she knows, and you can too, I'm sure, but I've watched her do it, and it's, you know, that kind of a trade is amazing to know how
no
to do that.
No one gets nervous, it's okay.
Yeah, yeah, you're all, don't worry, she'll be right tonight, she'll be fine. But for me, it was actually an amazing experience to go and have these people that really knew how to work with the land and were already butchers and bakers and things that here, there were a lot of people getting into the industry because it was going to be a new industry for them and they were going to start up something new. So in the Barossa, there was already a very strong tradition and in the wine as well, so it's there. Then in South Australia, there are distinct pockets of you know, areas of Asian and I'm thinking McLaren Vale, which is another large...
Italian, completely.
Yeah,
right.
Very much so.
Yeah.
I mean, it's quite distinct. And I think it's, if you compare it to California, you know, our population is tiny in comparison to California, even. I mean, it's just a completely different beast. But very, very much terroir-driven, I guess, but really driven by heritage more than anything. It's the Italians that moved to Adelaide, I mean, they all have their little gardens in the back. I mean, in some ways, they didn't really need a farmer's market because they're already growing everything. But then as the older generations, you know, pass on, the younger generations are now looking to things like farmer's markets, and there are not a lot of traditions passing along. So what we tried to do with at least the farmers market in the Barossa, and we are still doing, is trying to engage the younger people. And it's now kind of a cool thing because it small businesses are actually cropping up. Market gardeners are actually becoming viable, and they're producing breads and actually saying, well, maybe it isn't so weird that my grandfather and my dad were butchers, you know? I think I might think about doing that as a profession. So I don't know if that answers the question.
No,
I mean,
it's very interesting because then, since many of us have perceived Australia for decades as a beer-drinking culture, not a wine-drinking culture, for whom are most of the wines that you're making in Australia meant? Is it primarily an export industry? How much do people drink there? And is drink wine? How much is wine embraced?
Stop keeping a straight face.
How much is wine embraced? And particularly the premium end.
Well, I think it's important to note that most South Australians are very competent underage drinkers. I mean that in sincerity because, look, it's not a matter of... abusing a substance. It's a matter of our culture.
Yeah.
Because the heavy European influence in South Australia in the 1950s and the 1960s, we had quite a fledgling industry and we had an infrastructure that needed to be built. And the Italians, the Lebanese, the Greeks were the greatest influx to Australia, and South Australia in particular, and probably one of the best influences we've had, coupled with the early influx of Germans and so forth to the Barossa Valley and Handel, for that matter. But look, to the point, at the end of the day, Australia still is one of the large, well, if not, it is the largest now New World export country in terms of wine. If California was its own country, it would outstrip Australia in terms of production, or South Australia, should I say. But look, at the end of the day, Australians are very much heavy reliant on exporting our wines. It's one of our greatest successes, behind wheat and barley and a few other exports like the five people sitting on this table. But on the other standpoint too, we're parochial. We're very much so, and we drink a significant amount of our own wines, and we're a big beer-consuming nation too, and I don't mean that in a swilling matter. I mean that in an appreciation matter. We've got some great breweries in Australia we're very proud of. So I think to close on your answer, or your question, should I say, South Australians are very much a loyalist group of people, and very parochial to their own wines, and very much like other parts of the world, but we're not afraid to send our beer, our wine, our produce, our chefs, the list goes on, our seafood, to other parts of the world, because we know it as some of the best in the world, not just in Australia.
I do want to actually highlight that seafood. I mean, the Adelaide market, the central market, and just going down and seeing what we've got with seafood is just fantastic. I mean, and it's not, it's affordable as well. It's just very much part of the diet there. So it's quite a Mediterranean diet, very varied.
We have people coming in from Japan. They literally fly in on their private jets via certain sponsorships and literally land in Adelaide. They go to the central markets, they buy the best of the best bluefin tuna, load it on the aircraft and fly back to Osaka. And it's not uncommon to hear that. They're taking back the freshest seafood they can find, and South Australia has some of the greatest seafood in Australia, if not the southern parts of the hemisphere.
Well, just for anyone's interest who wants to try it here, I do know that there are quite a few seafood purveyors that bring in unique South Australian seafood, like our Southern Rock lobster, which is exquisite, and it's the only lobster you can eat sashimi. You can get Australian kingfish, mulloway, another is a really gorgeous one, but there are some really beautiful fish and crustaceans that are coming in, you know, the daily flights to the USA, beautiful, clean, pristine waters. The seafood out of South Australia is really stunning, and you can get it here, so keep your eyes out.
Before I get into some of these questions, which are really great, I want to talk a little bit about food and wine pairing. So I'm going to go down the line. Victoria, tell me what one of your, like, dream South Australian wine and food pairings would be.
A dream, well...
maybe a dream that you've experienced, actually.
Well, actually, I can actually answer that. And it was a very old Riesling. We were talking old Rieslings before. And it was a Clare Valley 1987 Riesling. And I had that. We had every Easter we do a seafood, and so I had made salt and pepper squid with fresh little baby squids that we'd got in, just gently tossed, with a very old Riesling, and that was the squid was gorgeous, and you could still taste the sea. Mm-hmm. Back when I could still eat oysters, it would have been probably what's the Petaluma sparkling.
Crozer.
A bottle of Crozer and fresh oysters from Coffin Bay. Couldn't really get much better than that.
So, Adrian, while you were there, what was one of the top wonderful pairings that you experienced?
Gosh, you know, we we certainly drank our way through the Barossa Valley, and our teeth were stained purple by the end of every day with all the Shiraz that we drank. And I'm not sure that I have a... It was solid eating and drinking for three solid days, and I don't think that I have a specific food and wine pairing there.
Big red wine, big red
stuff. Yeah,
big red wine.
I'd approach it the same way I would here.
Would be
the Shiraz with duck, with steak, with game. The Rieslings are great first course wines. The work with cheeses. I'd take the same approach I'd take here with it.
Well, I think and there's two answers to that question without taking up too much time. Firstly, it's a food and beverage match is my first one. That's at 4 a.m. in the morning with a Farmers Union iced coffee and a meat pie outside outside the front of the Adelaide Casino when literally you couldn't find a coherent thought with a flashlight pointed at your forehead. But on the standpoint of alcohol, probably I'd say the best food and wine match I've had, and very difficult question to answer because you've got to take company into the surroundings. But I'd say a Adelaide Hills Pinot Noir with a confit duck somewhere in McLaren Vale at the Star of Greece, looking out into the Pacific Ocean, sorry, the Great Southern Ocean. That'd be my best food and wine match.
I'm ready to get on a plane.
Was that detailed or what? I adore lamb. I'm a big lamb eater and always have been. My father's from South Australia, and he always brought us up eating a lot of it. And the lamb in South Australia, too, a lot of times in the Barossa is actually hogget, which is a bit older. It's not really lamb. It's two-tooth. That's right. We call it two-tooth. Four-tooth is mutton. So I like gamey, and I love a good Shiraz. So for me, it's a good Shiraz, and I don't really mind where it's from, but I'd say Penfolds would be quite good, and a really good roast lamb.
So. I've been nipped in the bud twice here. My first thing that came to mind was sitting at the Star of Greece having a crozer. So I'm going to go to the... I can't say this is any less exciting, but it was actually my first meal as an adult in Adelaide, and it was at Chong Lu's restaurant, which has been in the Grange, in surprisingly, in a Hilton hotel. And I was doing a story on him, and he brought me out his first dish, which is his signature, which is the Four Seasons, which is four different seafood preparations. And I was so taken with the food. I think I was having a semillon with it, but I just remember it was absolutely memorable. The ambience, the food, and just the localness of it, as well as the internationalness of it, because he was using the most local ingredients and yet infusing cultures, mainly Asian, because that's where he was from, but in just such a clever way. It was just memorable. So that would be mine.
Mm. Well, my mouth is watering. This first question I see is one that I actually wanted to ask, so I'll just go ahead. How long do you anticipate that it will take for American consumers to understand and appreciate regionality in Australian wine?
Oh. I get that question every day, so I'd like to hear someone else's answer. But no.
Well, I think it all has to do with what's available on the shelf, number one.
Do you think it's better through marketing or by training to sales staff, wholesalers, consumer tastings? Do consumers tend to drive things more than anything else?
I would actually say it's very hard to really understand anything until you go there at some level. So I think a lot of it has to, and I would highly encourage people, if you're interested in wine, and especially in Australian wines, I mean, there's so much wonderful wine in Australia, all across Australia. Go and try it. Don't just think Europe, you know? It varies completely across the country, and it's fantastic.
So. Yeah, look, to lead on from that, you're right. And you know, interestingly, I saw a couple of eyes frown when I said Pinot Noir. People think, oh, gee, I didn't know you grow Pinot Noir in Australia. Well, yeah, we actually have 60-plus wine regions in Australia, and of that note, there's wine regions in Australia that are cooler than parts of Burgundy, and not necessarily as cool as Champagne, but getting close in Tasmania. But look, I think at the end of the day, it comes down to education, obviously, but I think it comes down to consumer confidence. It also comes down to key messaging and everyone singing from the same hymn book. And at the end of the day, all South Australians will try and deliver that message of quality. But look, I think the key indicator behind this is diversity. There is so much diversity in South Australian wine and Australian wine, and that diversity will certainly lead you to be an armchair tourist tomorrow. And all you need to do is go down to SFO and get on Qantas, and you'll be in Adelaide. you'll be in Adelaide within 14 hours, and that's nothing with a glass of champagne and two sleeping tablets.
What's the difference between South Australia wines and wines from the West Coast of Australia?
Look, firstly, I think it's important to understand that Western Australia is one of the most isolated places on planet Earth. That said, it is one of the most beautiful places on planet Earth. Perth, which is a beautiful part of the world, is literally 8 hours from South Africa and about 3.5 to 4 hours from Adelaide. So it's a significant flight. At the end of the day, the wines from Western Australia, particularly Cabernet and Chardonnay, as the two main varietals over there. Cabernet seems to be quite Bordelaise-esque, very much like the wines out of the Napa Valley. Chardonnays tend to be quite lean, zesty, fragrant, that of Burgundy. In terms of South Australia, very hard to draw a comparison, but the South Australian primary grape is Shiraz, so you're looking at richness, fleshiness, juicy styles of wine, compared to the more elegant styles that you find in Western Australia. But look, the obvious answer is South Australian wines are significantly better than Western Australian wines.
Okay, so having said that, there's a question here. A person who is about to travel for the first time there, and which wine places do you recommend as a must-see?
Penfolds. Oh, I thought you were meaning in South Australia. I think Penfolds is definitely... the history, the restoration they've put into some of the old buildings, seeing the whole, getting the whole Penfolds story, and then having dinner at McGill Estate, it's absolutely memorable. But as also Bridgewater Mill, yeah. They're two of my favourites to go to for a wine and food
Hills.
Experience. Sorry.
and also, I would say actually the Margaret River, which is below Perth, absolutely beautiful. Mm. Coastline's fantastic. You do feel like you're on the edge of the world, which I think is a great feeling for those of us who like to feel that. And also Tasmania is another, the champagne that's made down there, the bubbles. There's some great wine. I'm a big Pinot lover, so that to me is great. And the Mornington Peninsula as well, which is Victoria down below.
And the Yarra Valley.
Yeah.
We could go on. We've got a lot.
It's kind of hard because it is very... And
pick
it is,
your varietals. Go
buy
your varietals.
It's so unique. And if you got to remember, Australia's the size of the United States. And so... And most states, even Queensland, make wine. And so... And most of the states along... Well, certainly New South Wales, Victoria, Tasmania, and Western Australia as well, and South Australia, of course, have wine regions that are pretty old and have really distinctive... character. So maybe what you should think about if you don't have a lot of time, what kind of wines do you like?
Yeah. Yeah.
Do you like big Cote de Rhone, opulent wines, head for South Australia, or zesty Rieslings like you might get in Alsace, go to the Clare Valley. So think about the wine styles that you enjoy and you'd like to explore, and then you can look at the different regions and you can kind of, if you get a little feel for them, you know, go to your local wine shop, grab a Hunter Valley, grab a Tasmanian, if you can find them. I suppose you can
you? Yeah, you can.
And maybe explore that before you go.
That's a great idea. This is for Adrian. What fish or seafood are unique to Australia and available now in the U.S.? Perhaps you and Sally can...
She had mentioned plenty. I'm not sure if Barramundi is unique to South Australia, but it's gained... a huge amount
it's
of popularity.
Yeah.
It's certainly Australian. The rock lobster I've seen.
Bugs.
Morton Bay. You can get yabbies.
Yeah.
For sure.
Bugs. People are saying bugs. What do you mean bugs?
Bugs are a very unique and almost prehistoric crustacean that... You can actually go to view from the band, look in their archives. You'll actually see one where I was doing a television segment Thursday, 2 weeks ago nearly. But they're almost like a cross between, what did you say, a lobster and a prawn and a crayfish.
Yeah.
Succulent, tender flesh, just really, really gorgeous. And there's marin, there's yabbies, there's Moreton Bay bugs, Balmain bugs, quite a few.
Can you get any of those here?
Yeah, you can get all of them here. I know Kalaloa Seafoods bring all those in, and you can order it off their website. There's probably quite a few other seafood purveyors that do as well.
What about cheeses, and what cheeses are going to be served tonight?
Well, cheese is a really hard one. You're in the cheese business, but I put a lot of research and a lot of effort into trying to get cheeses from South Australia here, and unfortunately, there's next to none that are actually imported into the States. I even had some of the very best cheese we tried there was from a maker by the name of Woodside, and they had gone to the trouble of packing it up specially for me and sent it, and it got turned away at the border and had to go back to them. It's really challenging. You have to go there to get it, but they're world-class cheeses.
It's hard to get. I mean, it's most of the producers are quite small in South Australia, so that we get them all. So another underline to have to go there to have them.
And are they mostly goat or
no? They're not mostly anything. There are quite a few goat producers, but there's quite a few
sheep.
Just like here, it's similar. There's mostly, I suppose percentage wise, it's mostly cow, and then I think second is goat, and then sheep, and then.
But the quality of these cheeses is outrageous.
Yes.
So much going into it.
The cheeses that do come, and you will see King Island cheeses, and you'll see some Victorian cheeses as well. It's a bit cooler there. I think the cows might be a bit happier, really. And I think the goats are happier in South Australia. I really don't carry very many. I can't get them. It's all about import-export. So
I'm happy they're being consumed locally.
I did bring one cheese that might be the only cheese that's imported, which is a Murray Bridge cheddar.
Mm-hmm. Okay, here is a question. I buy a large bottle of Lindeman's Australian wines, which is very good, for only $8 at Trader Joe's. How can they sell it so cheap, and how is the discounting of Australian wines handled? This is perhaps the most widely debated issue right now when it comes to Australian wines. Yes?
It is. And look, at the end of the day, there's a reason why some of these wines can be found at what has to be said, some of the best prices on the planet. It is significantly cheaper for us as Australians to buy our Australian wines in this market than it is to buy it in our home country, which is a bit odd. That said, at the end of the day, there are some supermarket chains that do have buying power, and they obviously flex their muscles when it comes to that, so they can, look to use an old cliche, pass on savings to their customers. Look, I think on the other standpoint too, the Australian wine industry has certainly suffered over the last 5 years with many makers in a race for the bottom in pricing. And I think a lot of that has been driven by Yellowtail, which no doubt is prolific throughout the United States, Canada, Central and South America. And with all due respect to John Casella from the Casella family, who is the manufacturer of these wines, he found a niche market and capitalised on that. Is it a reflection of Australia? My personal opinion, no. That said, there is certainly hats go off to John, because he's certainly responsible for introducing a lot of people to Australian wine. And a lot of people may not have ever drunk Australian wine in the past until they tasted a bottle of Yellowtail. So look, at the end of the day, to finish your question, the tide is turning. We're moving back to regionality. John is now pioneering markets like Asia and India, and you'll see a significant change in the way Australian wines are going to be seen in the United States via regionality, and the prices are not going to go up, so it's a good thing, but at the end of the day, you may struggle to find wines at the fighting varietal category of the $4 to $3 to $5, you'll see them probably closer to $7 to $8 and so forth. The person who bought the Lindeman's, stick to it. It's a fantastic wine.
Can I just add a short bit to that too? Because I think it is a great sadness that, and when I go out and do a lot of promotions where I might be pouring a wine, because I tend to focus more on the lesser known, more boutique regional wines that are a higher price tag, that people will say, well, why would I pay that when I can get Yellowtail or whatever for, you know, under $10? And these are the same people that have no qualms at all spending $20 to $30 on a California wine. And it is sad that those wines that are very drinkable, Australia makes good wine full stop, it seems, that people are, you know, happy to pay. But, you know, I encourage you to go out there and try some of our little more pricey wines, because the quality you'll get, and it'll still be great value, that you'll find some really exceptionally stunning wines out there to buy in anything you'll get from anywhere in the world.
Hmm. Very well said. And there's a question here that I find it difficult, but I'm going to say it. How do Australian wines compare with other countries' wines? Are they rated 1, 2, 3, 4, and 5? Compared to other countries.
System.
Exactly.
We have it all. I mean, again, we're a huge wine-producing country, and we have wines that would be a one, and we have wines that would be a five. I mean, we certainly, like, you know, you said Grange, but also, you know, if you think about Henschke, you know, I mean, we've got some wines that are that consistently win awards and best wine, and are people pay thousands of dollars for.
Just like any other wine region in the world, I would say.
Yeah, exactly.
I would go back to what you were saying about the, Matt was saying about the, you know, you had asked about rating, and I do think that, you know, there's a lot of trying to create wines that are going to be rated very highly, and I think what I'd like to see, and I'm sure I'm speaking for most of us here, is for people to really go for what they like, stop waiting for someone to tell them what's good.
People hate making up their own mind.
Right.
And yet you would never think of saying to somebody in those moments when you want comfort and you really want to eat something, you know what you want to eat. You wouldn't go to somebody and say, tell me what I want to eat now. And we have to become that familiar with how we want to, what we want to experience in that wine glass.
Unless what you're really going for is, well, what can I serve that's the most expensive? And
the
most expensive
the most
does not equal best often.
And neither does highest rated.
Right.
I would say that a lot of very highly rated wines are not very food friendly.
Right. And I think most of the people on this panel are food driven. So.
And we were talking before about Australian wines, and you were asking how they could get better known and whatever. Well, and I think I take my hat off to Lark Creek, because at the moment with their promotion, they're actually running South Australian wines in seven of the restaurants, along
yes.
with the menus.
Wow.
And for a California restaurant group to go out on a limb and say, we're going to serve South Australian wines and we're going to make the effort, you know, pair some food, I guess to me, as someone who wants to see South Australia promoted, two people who like food and wine, so we're already halfway there because we're in a restaurant, that's a great step forward. And if Australia can get its foot in the doors in different places, and I think it is. I think, you know, Sally would say there are restaurants that you've got that do open their arms to Australian wines on their menus. You know, I've had Australian people say to me, oh, you know, I just can't get my foot in the door in California. They just don't want to look at my wines. And I say, how many California wines do you have in your cellar back in Australia? So parochialism works both ways,
mm-hmm.
and it's about us all learning about each other, really.
Because if you really want to talk about regionality in wine, then every wine-growing region in the world has something to offer and something to experience. And that's one of the greatest things about wine, is it's like culture in a glass. You get to have that armchair traveler experience for those of us who can't just sleep on that plane to Adelaide.
Yeah, and don't forget, I mean, a lot of us study these things, you know, so once you've really started researching it and start to meet winemakers and, you know, suddenly you're much more apt to want to drink that kind of wine. I mean, you have to dive in. You can't just be told. You have to start doing it. And if you're really not interested in it, that's fine too, you know. Then you turn to Cooper's. It's a great beer.
That's the winemaker's that's the winemaker's beer.
Yes, sir. No. But I mean, you know,
what's the largest export market for Australian wines? Is it England?
Yeah, it is. It's the mother country. At the moment, they're about 200,000 litres in front of the United States. Last year, Australia exported about 750 million litres of wine. Of that, 480-something million went to the mother country, and then the United States was about 300-something million. So the United States second, Canada third, fourth being, let me think, I can't at the top of my head at the moment, but yeah, it's United Kingdom one, United States two.
Before we wrap up, is there anything that we haven't covered that you'd like to share? Seems like it's been pretty wide ranging.
I guess I'll encourage everybody to come into the Lark Creek restaurants and try the wine that we've brought in from South Australia and the menus that we've paired with it. It's kind of our own take on what a South Australian food and cuisine is. But what we've done is kind of taken the California approach, which is what I saw as being Australian cuisine, and we've used mostly our local ingredients. But there are some things that they have there that we don't have, and they import just fine. So we've chosen not to import, you know, kangaroo and Australian lamb and the seafood there because they wouldn't do that if they were here. But what we did bring in was a whole bunch of really great indigenous spices and spices and fruits, mostly Aboriginal discoveries. That you know, we have samples of a bunch of it for you to try and smell when you get out to the reception area.
What will people be drinking in the reception? Now, what will people be drinking?
There is a selection of obviously South Australian wines out there, but from what I saw, I was walking in the door. There will be wines from the Annie's Lane Winery, the Rosemount Winery, the Penfold Winery, and I'm sure there will be wines out there from Peter Lehman, maybe Darren Berg. And a few others, but there'll be a significant amount of wine out there to taste, and I'll be out there as well as all of us to help encourage the consumption. But more importantly, to answer some questions, because every one of us have lived and breathed the South Australian wine industry.
Well, I want to thank all of you. Thank you so much.
Thank you.